Select Committee on Judiciary, hearing April 29, 1975, 8 a.m. Senate Bill 30, 132, 748, 846, 887, 863.
Madam Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Dennis McFeely. I'm a senior attorney with the Seattle Regional Office of the Federal Trade Commission.
You want to give us a brief rundown of what the bill does? Nobody ever has, if you know.
Okay, well, the best thing for me to do then is to cover the summary as it appears in the front here.
We can read that.
Well, it redefines what it does is it broadens the jurisdiction of the state to deal with vocational schools, doing out-of-state vocational school in a more specific and concrete way than before through definitions that appear in the section. It also sets up minimum standards, minimum criteria that out-of-state schools and in-state schools must meet before they can be licensed, which is the first time this kind of language has appeared in legislation. It adds some language to the Trade Practices Act, which gives them the Attorney General jurisdiction, and which is not a matter that we're particularly concerned with ourselves. I think it's going to be opposed by Mick Gillette here, which is not a matter of concern for the Commissioner ourselves. It sets up an advisory board and provides that the holder in due course doctrine will not prevail in the case of paper, negotiable paper. Well, actually, it's not negotiable, where the loans are provided for the purpose of vocational education. There are some other small changes. Much of the language in here was drawn from the bill proposed by the staff of the Educational Committee of the state, and we endorse the bill very strongly. We feel it has some very, very good things in it. I would like to go ahead with my statement unless there's some other questions.
Go ahead.
The post-secondary proprietary school industry has exploded into a multi-billion dollar enterprise during the last decade and is one of the least regulated industries for its size and effect in our country. In an increasingly competitive and complex job market, private vocational education has acquired a new significance for millions of people. Private home study courses and resident vocational schools offer a unique opportunity to receive training in technical, trade, and business skills. The goal for the majority of these students is simple: to achieve a useful, more rewarding, better paying job with the hope of economic mobility. Private vocational schools offer advantages over colleges and universities by offering short courses and specialized training. But there is another side to the private vocational school industry. Although most schools provide adequate and beneficial training, many others do not. Large nationally owned schools can reach into ghetto, rural, and small town areas through blanket advertising. The advertising dreams are sophisticated and prey on the dreams of the naive, the unemployed, and the undereducated. With false promises of glamorous jobs or high starting salaries, these less sophisticated people are induced to enroll through high-pressure sales techniques and promises of non-existent jobs. As a result, students often become heavily indebted to loan companies, banks, or to the government for courses offering little or no education. On the other hand, they may find they have a skill thousands of others have, where only hundreds of jobs exist. The veterans using their educational grants are not able to use them later for more qualified training. Many of these people lose more than money and time. They lose hope. And that really is a very important point here in the area of vocational education or any education, that people who sign up and become involved with education and then become very disillusioned with the process really suffer psychologically and financially in a way that's not describable very easily. They are defeated by society, which promised they had a chance to them a chance to get ahead. The unscrupulous school operators cast a shadow over the entire private vocational school industry, damaging the credibility of those who do offer quality job skill training, and there are many. even though a school must be accredited by an accrediting agency before it is eligible for federal funding under a guaranteed loan program, many schools are often accredited without significant investigation. A survey by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare points out that most of the major accrediting agencies are self-serving, and reports, therefore, cannot help but contain a certain bias. The Veterans Administration has also shown its concern in this area. Deceptive practices continue because the massive proliferation of schools within the last decade has overwhelmed the Federal Trade Commission's enforcement resources. To correct abuses in this $2.5 billion industry, new and more effective local enforcement programs must be developed. In other words, since the enactment of the original proprietary school law in the state of Oregon, there has been a quantum jump in the size and activity of the proprietary school business, requiring the necessity to devote substantially more enforcement resources than before, certainly more than the commission can bring to bear. In the last decade, many privately owned vocational schools have been bought by national conglomerates. The loss of personal involvement, where the school owner was an individual or family, has changed the complexion of many vocational schools. While educating people is surely a motive of these conglomerates, running their schools at a profit has taken over as the prime incentive. The schools have become first a business and second a learning institution. There has become an ever-increasing need for these schools to enroll more students because the bottom line figure has taken precedence over preparing young people for this business world. Thus, the Federal Trade Commission is encouraging states to become more involved in regulating post-secondary proprietary schools. The commission has taken the unusual step of officially endorsing for enactment by the state a legislative model proposed by a task force of the Educational Commission of the state. It's the first time I know that the commission has ever taken a position on officially endorsed a piece of legislation for state action, other than the Model Unfair Trade Practices Act. Most of the amendments in SB 30 to Oregon's present law are drawn from this model law, although there are some other amendments in there that I think are admirable that are not drawn from the model law. We wish that more of the model law provisions had been proposed in SB 30, but in the absence of that possibility, we endorse SB 30 for enactment as a clear improvement. Generally, as to the Model Act, it is designed to prevent and correct abuses which may be common among some private vocational schools. The members of the task force, the ECF task force, represented various post-secondary proprietary schools, state agencies concerned with post-secondary education, as well as the Veterans Administration, the U.S. Office of Education, the National Accrediting Association. The ECF report was worked out over a long period of time with a great deal of effort and thought gone into it. These people worked together to write this model state legislation, and their commonality was their interest in good education being fairly and ethically provided to private vocational school students. Some of the sections of SB 30 which I would like to are particularly suited to prevent and correct problems in this area are as follows. The Act establishes minimum criteria for determining whether this school may operate in this state, the most important criteria being the school's ability to enable students to achieve a stated educational objective and to ensure that students will receive education consistent with the objectives of the course. At the present time, there has been little statutory material in the way of regulating course content. It requires truth in advertising and promotion, as well as affirmative disclosures in advance of relevant information in order to adequately inform prospective students prior to their enrollment. In other words, they would receive a disclosure statement, a brochure, setting out specifics. It clearly defines procedures and conditions under which any school or its agents may be authorized to operate in the state, and allows for denial or revocation of authorization to operate. The present proposal also requires improved school bonding. It provides for agency investigation, not necessarily triggered by a student complaint, into activities of the school or its agency, and allows the levying of civil penalties for statutory violations. In the past, I believe it was limited, the statute limited it to license revocation proceedings. We note that the proposal prevents use of the holder in due course doctrine, under which an institution uses a third party, that is a loan company, to collect payments from a student for services perhaps not provided or not provided satisfactorily. On balance, the proposed Senate Bill 30 offers Oregon an opportunity to deal effectively with program that has plagued the young, the less affluent, and the disadvantaged segments of society. Given adequate enforcement, it may serve as an alternative to federal involvement in an industry considered by many to be a state matter. In the words of Joseph A. Clark, president of the National Association of State Administrators and Supervisors, education is the inescapable responsibility of the state. Dominion over education was not delegated to the federal government by the Constitution, but rather was reserved to the state. Therefore, when a citizen of the state is victimized by a minority of the educational fraud, it is the responsibility of the state to see if the rights of the people of that state are protected, and the rights of the legitimate school operator as well. The need for this bill is urgent. In times of economic and job insecurity, like we have at present, and high unemployment, enrollment in vocational schools always increases. People are looking for new ways to earn income and look very frequently to vocational schools. This is precisely the time when Oregon needs to have the highest quality of education provided with the least deception and fairness. There is no way to predict how long our high rate of unemployment will last, but throughout this period, people of all ages will flock to these schools to better themselves, and in doing so, will be trying to maintain their economic independence and stay off the state's employment role. This legislative session will end soon. Therefore, I urge the committee to recommend and press for the passage of Senate Bill 30 as expeditiously as possible. And I have an aside remark that quite aside from what I just was commenting about it, and I see that according to the paper last night that the President of the United States is now in step and caught up with this committee and the legislature here and endorsed repeal of the fair trade laws. I was down here to testify on that law, a repeal. There are a couple of more comments that I would like to make about the bill or about this type of a law. I happened to be in the legislature in Washington on Friday afternoon, and although this state should follow its own course, the Washington Legislature Senate passed by 46-0 a stronger bill than this, modeled more closely on the ECF version. I would like to ask you to look at page 47 if you haven't got a copy, and get one if you haven't got a copy, of the Legislative Interim Committee on Education, where there is a several page rundown on the vocational schools and the problems and the money involved and the proposed resolution. There has been a lot of study and a lot of time put in to this bill in this state by Federal Trade Commission people and by people in the state locally. One of the main principal points involved here, I think, is that this bill better enables the state to deal with out-of-state schools who are becoming increasingly vigorous in their enforcement and their activities outside their own state of residence through mail order and other types of advertising. Those are the only comments I had.
Thank you. That's my feeling. Mr. Led?
Senator Brown, members of the committee, I'm Michael Gillette, Solicitor General, appearing this morning representing the State Consumer Protection Division, a capacity in which I have not appeared before the legislature since 2 years ago. It was time Senator Smith was kind enough to carry a technical amendment bill that I had asked to be enacted from Senator Roberts' committee. As you will note, Madam Chairman, I am appearing in opposition to part of the bill, which may seem kind of strange, but the bill proposes beginning at page 17, actually beginning at page 18, and again at page 20, some revisions to the existing Unfair Trade Practices Act, which we think are unnecessary, and we would suggest the language be stricken. First at page 18, lines 19 through 21, there is some specific language which is designed to give us jurisdiction over instructional and training opportunities offered for the purpose or purported purpose of training, teaching, etc. We think we already have that jurisdiction, and we think the beginning of the use of language of this sort creates one of those inclusio unus est exclusio alternus problems that we've run into in the law where once we've included something, it appears we've excluded everything else. So we'd like to see the original language of that subsection restored. You notice that the language there that I pointed to does two things. One is it purports to give us jurisdiction, I think we've already got, and it also gives us jurisdiction over insurance by taking out the former exclusion of insurance from the Consumer Protection Division's coverage, and we think that ought to be put back in. We have no reason to think that Mr. Rawls and company are incapable of handling that job in a perfectly adequate fashion based upon an understanding we've had with them since the inception of the Consumer Protection Division. We really don't want that additional jurisdiction. Secondly, at page 20, we would ask that at lines 9 through 12, we would ask that that proposed new section has to be deleted. That language is clearly covered, as far as I'm concerned, by subsection E of the existing Unlawful Trade Practices Act, subsection E of 646-608, which appears at lines 1 through 3, at page 19. We just simply don't need the language. What we're saying is we think the primary obligation for enforcement of this act should belong to the board, to the State Board of Education. If they demonstrate that they're incapable or unable to perform the job, then I think we have existing jurisdiction which will enable us to handle whatever's left over, and I prefer not to have new language inserted in Chapter 646.
What's your feeling about the whole bill? Do you have any desire for it?
The problem to which the bill speaks has been a growing national problem. I think as a whole, the bill probably is good.
You don't have adequate legislation to deal with it?
We have adequate language in our legislation to deal with the problem on a piecemeal basis, but we don't have the kind of licensing and all-encompassing approach this bill would give the Department of Education. The point is, I think they ought to get the first shot at it for certification purposes and otherwise, rather than have us step in after the barn door's already been torn off the hinges and try to remedy individual problems.
Questions?
Madam Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I noticed that somewhere in the document that there was a question of constitutionality regarding controlling out-of-state vocational training schools. Could you comment on that?
To the extent that a school purports to do business in this state, there's no more question about our right to regulate what it does within this state than there is to regulate any other business which is required to register to do business here and to meet certain other requirements. I don't see any particular interstate commerce problems under the interstate commerce clause.
Yes, Mick, on your suggestions concerning page 20, lines 9 to 12,
mm-hmm.
I appreciate you said you think that is currently covered by 646.608. What were the particular subsections or subsection that you felt covered that
subsection
back on?
Subsection E on page 19, lines 1 through 3.
Right.
Represents the real estate business service as sponsorship, approval, characteristics, ingredients, uses, benefits, or qualities. In other words, if the claim is that our product will guarantee you employment in the construction industry or something of the sort, that's a claim of a quality or ingredient or a characteristic which it doesn't have.
You're basically saying that the more general language will cover this more specific harm or danger.
Yeah, we've been able to deal with some fairly far-reaching claims under subsection E without too much difficulty.
And back to the materials on page 18, lines 19 to 21.
Yeah.
Is your thought that this is covered by other similar business opportunities, or why?
No.
Why the objection?
No, we think it's a service offered for personal use.
Under what subsection is that?
Same one, subsection 7. Real estate goods or services means those which are or may be used or bought primarily for personal.
I see.
And I think that's enough because that's what these are for, personal use, personal advantage.
If you can, I wish you'd say, Mr. Edwards is going to testify on the bill. Your office has advised him that the subject is adequately covered, yet it seems that some of the district attorneys can't find a law to prosecute under. So if you can say, I wish you'd say.
I plan to.
Mm-hmm.
One more question.
The Congressman.
The
you know of any specific abuses in this area that have not been controlled by the State Board of Education or your office?
Senator, there were some, but it's been so long since I was in the Consumer Protection Division that to claim adequate memory of them now would be inaccurate. I can recall some school advertising, particularly in the heavy equipment industry, that was significantly misleading.
You had authority to control it at that time?
Well, we did. The problem was that people had already come in and signed up, and some of the money was gone, and the outfit was operating out of Idaho. If they'd been required to register to do business before they even came in, the advertising wouldn't be published. But it's been so long, I can't give you any more specific description than that. They would have, under the terms of this act, they would have been required to register to check over before.
Is this
going to
continue?
Thank you,
Mr. Edwards.
Yes.
He's on.
Madam Chairman, before
Mr. Edwards, can I provide some number of clippings and newspaper articles and so on for the record that relate to this subject matter?
What's the bill, Susan?
863.
Well, I guess it's been tabled, is that right?
That's right.
So it's in the other book.
Right there? I think it should be in that book you have. Tabled bill should be right at the back.
Yeah, there's a red tab.
It's
go ahead, Mr. Edwards. State your name for the record, please.
Thanks, Madam Chairman. My name is Cecil Edwards. I'm Secretary of the Senate. I'm here to testify on at least the purposes of Senate Bill 863, which I understand that the letter of the Attorney General's office found some defects in the bill. My purpose here is primarily to direct attention of the committee to the need for some kind of legislation that would provide penalties for breaking into the computer systems of the state of Oregon. And I also understand that private industry is concerned because there's been a very sophisticated type of thievery of breaking into these systems, which has included writing checks and various other things. In Oregon, of course, I recited previously of the one break-in that we had. And while I note in this letter, doesn't take kindly to the bill, that I believe there's adequate laws now. Well, at the time of the break-in, Mr. Fellinger, to the Motor Vehicle Department, where the legislative computer systems booked in, I was advised that they didn't have sufficient law to prosecute for him. He made his guilt very widely known and got publicized, and even published a paper of his sophistication and how easy it was to break into the system. The system was down for a number of hours, and a number of records were at least used the word tampered with. So I would like to see some kind of legislation that is adequate to take care of this. And I'd like to have Mr. Stowe, who's a technician, speak for a moment on this if I may.
Right, go ahead.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Stowe. I coordinate the Legislative Information System and report to the Administration Committee. The area of security, I think, is reaching out more into the national scene because of the movement of data processing into all forms of life. Because of that, people are becoming more and more concerned with data processing security.
Thanks.
And here in the state of Oregon in particular, we've been very concerned with our data files and securing those data files. I think in the legislative system, we spend considerable amount of our time in concern with that particular area. And the concern, I think, is because there are no statutes that we're aware of that really protect the files from tampering. And all of the other data processing professionals in the state that I've talked to are not aware either of those of any kind of protection. Primarily, what we have to do now is through our own. It's kind of like trying to build a better burglar system without having laws to protect your home. We try to outthink whoever might get into the system or might tamper with it, and we do the best we can in doing that. But presently, there's no way really to keep anybody out of any files. It's really akin to protecting your house or anything else. People can get in if they're expert enough, and depends on how good a job you do in protecting it. Presently, we know of no protection of present statutes.
Well, Nick, why don't you come to the table? What is the answer? Nick is the answer. Just say that.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I wrote the letter to the committee concerning this bill after examining it in some detail. I guess the computer that was involved in this case is located in Marion County. I don't know. Either Marion or Benton. Which was it?
The operation started in Benton County, but computers in Marion County.
Okay.
Back on telephone invasion.
It appears to me that the existing language of the criminal mischief in the third degree statute just simply specifically covers what was done. That is to say, a person who did not have the right to do so, or reasonable ground to believe that he had such right, and with the intent to cause substantial inconvenience to the owner of property to which the data bank itself interfered or tampered with the data bank. And that seems to me to fit right within the language of the existing statute. It's because of that I am at a loss to understand why the district attorney of either county would have denied prosecution. Had I been the DA, I'd have prosecuted the guy in a minute. Now, my office was not consulted, as we frequently are in these strange cases, on whether or not jurisdiction exists, and our advice would have been sure it does, had we been asked.
The possibility for theft must be enormous, but you get away with an intangible thing that might be hard to value. Are the penalties adequate for the type of thing that might happen?
Well, I'm trying to remember how the theft statute is worded. I'd have to dig it out, but I think the stealing of the information is, even though it's inchoate or an intangible, I think it is theft. And I think its value is probably reached for the theft statute as well. John, you want to check? Because I'm not positive about that. That raises a different question. But in any event, if the value of the information which is obtained is a concern to the committee, the criminal mischief statute, especially criminal mischief in the third degree, is not the place to try to reach that. Rather, we should try to include it in the theft statute by trying to figure some way to set a value on the materials involved. Because if someone, you know, steals a name, that's one thing, and maybe it's worth so much. If, on the other hand, if you steal some kind of state secret in the sense of material on state bidding processes, so on the other hand, that may be much more serious. In any event, I don't think amending this statute is the way to get at it. I'm particularly concerned, as I indicated in my letter, about the line that appears at the end of line 15 and the start of line 16, and I'm afraid you're going to hear me testify to this point again when the Security and Privacy Bill comes up. The line, disclosing any database, data file, or other data in such system. If all that is disclosed is material which is otherwise a matter of public record, if all that is disclosed is simply a matter of public record and what the person has done is obtain a compilation of that information, and the person who does the disclosing is, for instance, a newspaper reporter, just to make an example as outrageous as possible, he may be guilty of criminal mischief with respect to breaking in and grabbing the stuff, but his disclosure, I don't think, can be punished criminally because you're making a criminal penalty for disclosure of information which is otherwise public, and that's unconstitutional.
Cecil, can you get us the DA who felt that they couldn't prosecute?
Can I do what?
Find name. Be able to give us the name of the DA who did not prosecute this case.
Gortmaker is the DA.
carries appeals, but we do not, at least it's very rare for us to discuss the ongoing cases with Gary's office. If it were Jimmy Brown in Benton County, who I think also had jurisdiction over this case, he should have been asked to prosecute it. I know, I'm just sure he would have, and we'd have talked about it.
Do you feel anything?
Well, no, I do urge that the committee take note of this and do something to beef up the present statutes, which I've been advised they're not adequate to cover this kind of situation. And the sophisticated tamper, or however you want to describe him, doesn't just bother with getting information. In the Wall Street Journal, there was an article about him using breaking in and getting checks written. The thing is very vulnerable, and something needs to be done about it. And Oregon is going more and more to computerized information, and some of the information, of course, is secret. The income taxes will be on them, adoption proceedings will be on them, and all in the long-range program. And we apparently do not have sufficient coverage. Lundy drafted the bill, and Lundy didn't feel we had sufficient coverage. And at the time of this, I called the AG's office. I can't remember whether I talked to Durham or who, Rowling, or who it was, but they didn't feel that there was sufficient statutory coverage. The man was very flagrant about the whole thing.
Questions? Senator Brown.
Aren't there sufficient criminal statutes for the divulgence of, say, classified income tax records? That
I
you
think,
can approach
think
it through the specialized.
I think there are. I think there are. But I don't think that was should be the point here. It's doing things to the system that breaks it down or destroys information.
It's the tampering, I think.
That's right. I'd like a comment from the technician, if I may, if you have a moment.
Yes, I see. State your name for the record, sir.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dan Miles. I work for the Legislative Systems under Bill Stoke. I am the technical manager for the Legislative Systems Group. My primary concern in our environment is the fact that, as Bill has stated, that the computer system is very vulnerable, that it can be broken into, information can be destroyed, and this is the thing that we're, in our particular environment, more concerned about than having information stolen and divulged, is the fact that it can be, files can be deleted, they can cause considerable inconvenience. And that most any computer system is very vulnerable to someone who understands the technical considerations of how to actually, what passwords are required, how information is stored.
Have you had any problems with our computer?
We haven't up to this point. No.
How long have you been operating?
The oldest has been in operation for about a year. We were on the executive computer system.
Is there anything that you couldn't rebuild? Is it a problem with rebuilding the information, or is it a it's not a security problem?
Okay, in our particular environment, it's not a security problem as far as not allowing information to get out. In other
right.
words, the information is public. It
right.
causes, in some cases, there's some information that could not be recovered on a daily basis. We back up our files on a weekly basis. Motor vehicles backs up their files. It would be a matter, if a file were deleted, of re-entering the information, which would require from 10 to $200 or $300 or more of state entry personal work.
Good question. Thank you. Back to Senate Bill 30.
Cecil, do you want this back? You want it turned in?
Okay. Gerald Nicholson?
Back to 30?
30.
Should be an education committee.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Daryl Nicholson, and I represent the Oregon Private School Association, which consists of about 16 schools here in the state of Oregon. For the most part, it is our feeling that Senate Bill 30 is a bill that we can live with. It's not all bad. However, there are a few comments that I would like to make in regard to some of the sections that we do disagree with and we would like to be heard on. My first comment is on page 7, section 9, line 24. It talks about the annual license fee increasing from $50 to $100. I can
line 24?
Yes, line 24. At the present time, the annual license fee is $50, and they're proposing increasing it to $100. And I can really see no reason for adopting this proposed increase. My second comment is on...
Do you also pay local license fees? For example, if you have a school in Portland, that's Northwestern Business School, do you pay a local license in addition to the state license at the present time?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
This is the single license fee you pay for
yes.
your operation?
Yes. Okay, section 10, page 8, line 6 through 30. This section on fiscal responsibility has been picked up from a Colorado law which has been in effect for about 2 years. However, it's interesting to note that the state Department of Education in Colorado has found this law so difficult to administer that they are proposing a revision to their current legislation. Of all of the negatives that I will mention regarding Senate Bill 30, this is the one that we probably find the most difficult to live with. At the present time, a private vocational school, our vocational schools are paying a current bond of $2,500. Of what value would it be to increase that bond to 8 times what we're paying now? And this really is what we would be doing if we adopted the proposed legislation. As well as increased cost, the school would have, of course, a very cumbersome time constantly changing its bond or escrow agreement if prepaid tuitions are used. And just for your information, we register students and start students once a month. And of course, we constantly have students leaving. And this would, of course, create a real difficult accounting task for each one of our schools. So this would be one of the most difficult parts of Senate Bill 30 that we would have to live with. We don't like. I'm not aware of any other business that is required to do this. Mr. Barber of the State Department of Education has estimated that in order to enforce this section as it is written and make it operative would cost in excess of $100,000 per year. And of course, I can't bring myself to believe that this is what the taxpayers need. Thirdly, on page 12, section 16, lines 16 through 21. This part of the bill addresses itself to the advisory committee, and I am opposed to seeing past graduates on the advisory committee. What I would recommend, rather than seeing four past graduates of proprietary schools on the advisory committee for a period of 4 years, which is a very long time, I would propose that we have 7 members from private vocational schools to serve 4 years each, 3 members from industry to serve perhaps 2 years each, and 1 member from a private vocational school student body or a recent graduate of a private vocational school to serve perhaps for 1 year. Page 15, section 22, lines 16 through 31. I find this requirement very, very unprofessional, and that, of course, is posting in innocuous place, a sign reading, if you are not satisfied with the course, teacher, grades, or curriculum objective, please write directly to the State Department of Education. I think this is very, very inappropriate to hang on the walls of a proprietary school. First of all, I don't think that we want to put ourselves in a position of suggesting the negative, and it would be, if I could draw a parallel, it would be like a medical doctor notifying his patients in writing that they are not receiving the type of treatment they deem best, or if they are not satisfied with the results of any medical treatment, they can receive satisfaction by writing to the State Board of Health or the Surgeon General. Surgeon General.
Your nearest lawyer. Malpractice.
Right. Okay, section 28 and 29, page 18, line 16 through 20. Line 16 through page 20, line 8. This part
once
of
more.
The bill.
Once more, would you repeat this idea?
Yes, section 28.
What's the page number as for starts?
Okay, the page is page 18. Okay, line 16. And then, of course, I would like to address the remainder of my remarks on through 646. I disagree with the philosophy of making proprietary schools part of the Consumer Protection Act. In other words, what we're doing here is we're bringing 345 into 646. I don't necessarily object to what is being said in here, but wouldn't it be more reasonable to bring 646 into 345 so that we can have proprietary schools under one hat? Thank you.
Thank you.
What kind of bill do you approve of?
Well, for the most part, as I have already stated, Senate Bill 30 is not, it's not all a bad bill.
Well, I just wondered which one you like. I think you touched just about every section.
Well, I guess I would have to go through and pinpoint, but I don't think I've touched, I think there's only four areas that I've touched on.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Peterson?
Chairman, I'm Walter Peterson, president of Oregon Career Institute, accredited vocational school in Portland. There are a number of the provisions of this bill which I do support. Going down by page, starting on page 14. As I recall reading through this, this is modeled after the written after the model state legislation. I think the features in this bill which speak to the standards of schools, I certainly support. Another specific item on page 20, under section 30, I think this is a needed addition. I'm particularly sensitive to this particular feature because our company is being on a lease for a third party that was assigned to somebody else, and your attorney said you have no defenses against the leasing company, so I know what a situation, being in a situation like this, and I don't think that
you signed up as opposing the bill.
Excuse me?
You signed up as opposing the bill.
I'm speaking to favor the point that I'm in favor of the bill now. There are several features I'm in favor of. The next point I want to comment to is on page 8, and basically I reiterate what Mr. Nicholson said regarding this. I think it would be a very difficult provision to police. Further, I question, well, I'm not sure that there is a problem. I would, let me say this. I think if there were a situation where there were large amounts of unearned tuition collected in advance, then there may be some problem to speak to this particular problem. I don't see that this is the case. It certainly isn't in our case. And I think in most of the financing, it's the exception when a student pays in full when he starts. You know, the guaranteed loan program now, the disbursements are made in multiple disbursements. I can see where a situation in the past when it was, when the whole disbursement was made initially, there may be a problem. I don't see how you could adequately enforce the provision to say that you should have adequate, a term adequate financing, and you should have a capital structure that is adequate to fulfill the commitments of the school. I don't know who would really say that this was, who would make this determination. The next point I wanted to comment on was on page 12. Our particular school is accredited by the National Association of Trade and Technical Schools, and I've done some work with that accrediting commission in visiting other schools. And the concept that we use is using subject specialists on the team that visits the school. And I think this adds a lot to the meaningfulness of this procedure. I would think that if members of the industry in which we serve were serving on this advisory committee, they could add a lot to the meaningfulness of the committee. And I would suggest that this be added in lieu of the four students. Those are the comments of the bill that I wish to speak to.
Thank you, sir. Mr. King?
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, my name is Lewis King. I'm the member of the law firm of Rankin, Walsh, Reagan, and Roberts. Our firm represents Northwest School, which is a private vocational school having its headquarters in Oregon. By letter of April 17 of this year, Howard Rankin, our firm, wrote to the committee expressing three concerns with regard to Senate Bill 30. It is to these concerns I would address myself today. Section 10 of the bill deals with the issuance or renewal of licenses to vocational schools providing in part, quote, no vocational school shall be issued a license or have its license renewed until the superintendent determines that the vocational school is financially sound and reasonably capable of fulfilling commitments to students for instruction and training in the license year. We believe that the intent of this section is certainly good, but although there are standards stated in that section of the bill, these are not necessarily exclusive standards that must be used by the superintendent in making his determination as to whether to grant issuance or renewal of a license. We believe, therefore, that this provision grants an exceedingly great amount of subjective authority in the superintendent, and in order to ensure what we believe would be uniform application of this authority in the superintendent, we would like to see specifically stated standards which must be used as the sole criteria in making his determination. It's not to say that we wish to limit his powers, but we do wish the specific standards, however stringent, be stated in the bill. The second area of concern deals with Section 16, which would increase the number of the advisory committee from 7 members to 11 members. I do not believe that this raises any legal problems, so I will not go into it further at this time. I would only refer you to the comments contained in the April 17 letter. The third section with which we have concern deals with Section 22, which would require the following notice to be stated in all contracts between an Oregon private vocational, pardon, an Oregon vocational school and a resident student. Quote, any inquiry students may have regarding this contract or the course or program, which is the subject of this contract, may be made in writing to the school, paren, name and address, close paren, or if response is not obtained from the vocational school within a reasonable time, to the superintendent of the Public Instruction Department of Education, giving his address, close quote. We question the concern that this notice might cause in the student's mind, especially that portion regarding the failure of the private vocational school to respond to a student's inquiry. We recognize the problems inherent in requiring out-of-state vocational schools to meet this requirement by putting that provision in their contract. You really can't do that, probably. But to require the Oregon vocational school to do that may create a competitive disadvantage to the Oregon school. In other words, the student who's shopping around to see what course he's going to take, look at the Oregon school, sees this about failure to respond, may have a little concern on the out-of-state school, perhaps not required by any federal law at this moment or by a state law to put such a notice in, doesn't see that. And subconsciously, if not consciously, the student may say, well, you know, I kind of like this contract better than the influence.
Madam Chair?
Syndicate.
Why couldn't we require the out-of-state school? It seems to me we have the right to establish conditions for those who are doing business in the state.
There's a Supreme Court case referred to as the Pig case. I don't exactly have the side on it, but I know Catherine Bethay of the Legislative Council's office has extensive memorandum on it, which says basically that if an out-of-state vocational school comes into the state only by mail, not through agents, not through offices, and deals with students by mail, there's a severe question as to whether or not the state can legislate or require stringent requirements on that out-of-state school and its conduct, on the theory that you'd be interfering with purely interstate business as opposed to intrastate business.
That's your question, Matt.
Well, there's a substantial line of cases Well, I think this may be one reason behind the FTC, you know, but they're going to try to make it uniform nationalized.
National is not doing very much on correspondence schools or anything else. We really rely on them. We're sure leaning on a broken crutch.
Well, let me make the point that I don't, you know, we think the bill is good. We're not trying not to make it, you know, less wrong, but we're trying to specify the requirements.
Thank you very much. Mr. McGarry? State your name for the record, please.
Thomas McGarry. I'm the Assistant Veterans Service Officer from Alabama County. I would like to testify in favor of Senate Bill 30 as one step in the beginning to correct a history of past abuses by private vocational schools and hopefully to extend it to correspondence schools. In particular, we support some of the sections that have been attacked by some of the previous witnesses. Section 22, which is the question of the contract between the school and the student, and the disclosure statement where a student can file, receive information, or express a complaint. Our past experience over the last 2 years has shown that people that have that veterans in particular have a high dropout rate from private vocational schools, and that often feel that they've been mistreated, that they've paid exorbitant rates, and they simply don't know where to complain. They don't, rather an unsophisticated group as a whole, and don't have the knowledge as to where to complain, either to the state, the Consumer Protection Agency, or the State Board of Education, and a public note posting of an address of some authority would hopefully alleviate some of the problems. Also, Section 28, on page 18, which would make private vocational school part under the Consumer Protection Agency or the Consumer Protection Act, the one source of relief that students have had in the past has been the Consumer Protection Agency run by the state. The Portland office has been very cooperative. In fact, last year, they were able, in less than a month, to prevent a fairly blatant abuse in which some schools were advertising in a phone book that they were VA-approved, and private vocational schools aren't VA-approved. They're approved by the state of Oregon. And in terms of a contract between the Veterans Administration and the state, and there were several schools that had historically
advertised as being VA approved. They testified when this bill was LB 240. The telephone company representatives testified that they would not change this, even though they knew this was not true. And the Consumer Protection Agency, in a matter of weeks, received letters from several schools stating that they would change their advertisements. And in fact, those advertisements have been changed. So the Consumer Protection Agency is an effective means to prevent abuse by prevent private vocational school.
Is that 73 session, the Senate Bill 240, or this session?
This session.
This session. Where is that bill?
I believe 240 evolved into SB 30. I'm not sure.
I don't think that's an action.
Go ahead.
Okay, also section 27, which would allow community college credit for courses taken at private vocational schools. This would, in terms of veterans in particular, would allow a veteran to utilize, prevent him from having to utilize a change of program. The GI Bill, as it states now, allows only a limited number of changes after which those are used up. The veteran has to go through a VA-approved counseling. The problem is that it takes several months to set up. The approval is usually given, but if he enrolls in school while the counseling is being scheduled, he won't receive any benefits and creates a hardship. Hopefully by granting credit for private vocational school courses.
Senator Robert,
is that provision in here?
Yes.
Where?
Section 27, I don't have a line.
That credit from a correspondence school will be accepted
may
by the community college? So they may grant it, but does it require the community college to accept it?
No.
Page 17, line 13.
Okay, so it's entirely up to the community college to decide whether or not they'll accept the...
Right. This would give us some authority, whereas in most cases, community colleges don't. Mm. This would apply especially to vocational technical programs, not purely academic credit.
Are you through, sir? Are you through?
I just one more, section 29, which again applies to the misrepresentation. Again, it goes back to the school claiming to be VA approved.
Thank you. 132, Wynn Calkins.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I've already presented some extensive written and former testimony on this, and I don't plan to be too lengthy. But the committee will recall that this is proposed as a substantial improvement to the law in Oregon on affiliation proceedings. The old law is in Chapter 109, and it was adopted first in 1917. The primary purpose of Senate Bill 132 is to bring about greater convenience and fairness and less cost to the parties in this type of litigation. Experience in the past has shown that although paternity suits do not arise very often in our courts, that when they do, it can be a great deal of inconvenience and cost to the parties.
Okay, Madam Chairman?
Senator.
On the effective date, is there any reason why we shouldn't attach the emergency clause and make it effective immediately, or is there some reason why we ought to have a delayed effective time?
No, I can see no reason why this should be an emergency clause if the committee so.
In other words, what we're talking about is someone who's in this situation, and the question is there a reason why it should be delayed? Really, the only people that are going to need to know about this are the lawyers that are handling it. It isn't something that a person could get into trouble, not an average person couldn't get into trouble not knowing that it's effective or not effective.
Well, I think that is true. The major portions of the act, as far as the attorneys, now when you do get over into the adoption area and where this bill might affect adoption proceedings, the various state agencies concerned with that might need to know something about it.
Well, then, do you think it ought to be made effective January 1 of 76 rather than
really hadn't thought about that until now, but I think it would be worthwhile to maybe have a delay in it so that people can study up on it.
The reason I raised the question is because I left the effective date blank, and I'm inviting someone to decide.
Yeah.
Would you say January 1 of 76?
I think that would be a fair time to allow for adjustment for it. Now, the things that might be considered as important in this act as far as changes in the Oregon law is Section 10 makes the child a party. Now, it's my understanding this occurs most often anyway in our courts now, but this spells it out so that there's no doubt. There's greater confidentiality in Sections 21 and 24. All hearings are confidential. All the proceedings are kept confidential. There's a greater fairness to the child in that agreements between the parents can't prevent ultimate action by the child in Section 7. There are also guidelines for the judge which are not in the present law under Section 15 regarding support and custody situations. Also, there's a provision for enforcement and modification of support under Section 18 and 19. The greatest central point in this bill as far as avoiding high cost and inefficiency in the present law is in the pretrial proceeding in Section 11 of SB 132. This provision provides for, as I mentioned, a pretrial proceeding. Again, this is confidential. It's an informal hearing, and testimony may be had, and also the blood test evidence may come forth at this time. It's felt that the blood test evidence being brought out at this time will stimulate settlements in a large or high percentage of these type of cases. This act is designed to fit in well with the Uniform Blood Test to Determine Paternity Act, which we already have in the ORS 109.250.
You looked at Senate Bill 887?
Yes. Would the committee like me to comment on that?
Briefly.
Okay. Again, this is a fairly broad piece of legislation and does take in the subject matter proposed in Senate Bill 887. Now, the primary area where this comes about is because of the new constitutional requirements of notice to the unwed father, and this particularly becomes important in adoption proceeding situations. Section 25 of the proposed SB 132 covers this area. Now,
are the two bills incompatible? Could they both pass?
I think it could be worked out. Now, Section 25, although 132 is kind of an integrated procedural thing, which I think doesn't submit to compartmentalizing it, Section 25 deals with a somewhat different issue, and it has to do with notice of the unwed father.
Section 25 of 887?
No, 25 of 132. And if, I mean, I don't have any particular, you know, personal preference for this Section 25 and the way it goes about service on the unwed father, notice to him. It may be felt that 887, the central sections of that, as I understand it, are Section 7 and 8 as far as notice to the unwed father. And I see no reason why you couldn't incorporate that approach in Section 25 of this bill if it is felt preferable.
So what's the difference between the two and which are yours? Which one do you prefer?
Section 25 of 132, I have a slight preference for. Now, I'm not an expert in the adoption area myself, and of course, Mr. Joss, who is proposing 887, has a greater expertise than I do in that area, and I would respect his judgment. I feel that the Section 25 of 132 provides safeguards in that the court makes inquiry into the possible fathers that must be served, and I feel that it satisfies the constitutional requirement. Also, in the subsection of 25, it says
says, subject to disposition of an appeal upon expiration of 6 months after an order terminating parental rights is issued under this subsection, the order cannot be questioned by any person in any manner or upon any ground, including fraud, misrepresentation, failure to give any required notice, or lack of jurisdiction of the parties of the subject matter. This provides a 6 month cutoff date in which the order for termination cannot be questioned. Now, 887 provides a year cutoff based on fraud. I feel that the 6 month cutoff provides a additional safeguard as far as adoption proceeding. I feel more constitutionally secure with Section 25 of 132 also, although it could be argued that it is somewhat more cumbersome than approaching 887. I just, as I say, I'm no expert in this area, but I would think that 887 could be incorporated into Section 25 if that is the premise of the
committee. Thank you. Senate Bill 846. Bill Jones.
Next,
he's only signed up on it after we're through. You can talk about it if you want to.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Phil Bischoff, and because of the limited time, I hope not to take too much of your time on 846. Frankly, it is an attempt to authorize for the state what has already been very successful in Multnomah County, and that is the issuance of a certificate of adoption, which does not disclose the natural names of the parents. And this is a form you might want each to take a copy. I only have the one original. That's the form that the judge signs at the time of the hearing and grants to the adoptive parent. Then there is another form, which is a certified copy issued by the clerk. First one is signed by the judge. The second one is the usual certified copy that only the clerk signs. And so, Judge Lewis of Judge Multnomah County devised these certificates, and I sent her a copy of Senate Bill 846, and she wrote saying that it was fine, but because in the bill I didn't make any reference to the first form of certificate which the judge signed, she commented that she always felt a little stupid to give a certificate that says the decree was granted by the Honorable Judge so-and-so and then sign it in the presence of the people. And hence the judges in Multnomah County, where the certificate is given at the time of the hearing, use that first form. And to make the bill conform to Judge Lewis's desire for more flexibility there, which seems to me is entirely in order. And as a matter of fact, in the original form of the bill, you will notice that line 23, 24 is the one that provides for certification by the clerk. Page 26 to 27 provides for signature by the judge. And essentially, with reference to Judge Lewis's point, I'm suggesting with the form of amendments there that the word or the undersigned judge in parentheses be inserted after the blank at the end of line 16 on page 1.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
This is a very nice thing that the judge does, and I've been present several times when the judge has done this. But is it really something that we need to put in the law? Isn't it really just putting in a bunch of more record keeping and certificates and
they're really not needed for anything, are they? Isn't this more of just a nice thing to impress the parents that something important that has happened, and here it is, and here's the certificate, and everybody feels good when they walk out? That's fine. I don't object to that. It's very nice. But does it really accomplish anything except for your bill, except for creating a lot more bookwork?
Assembly Cook, there's one other factor of judgment. A attorney mentioned to me last week, and that was that in most adoptions, the adoptive parents do not know or want to know the names of the natural parents. And so they either receive nothing in writing certifying the adoption, or else they are handed by the attorney a certified copy of the decree that has the natural names of the child and of the parents there. So this does have the purpose of providing for a proof of adoption, still keeping confidential the natural names of the adopted child's parents and natural parents that's in the decree. Secondly, I don't know for sure, but I have heard that there has been some reluctance of judges and other circuits in the state to issue certificates of adoption in that they are not authorized in the code.
What if, though, we were to provide that the county clerk or his equivalent would, upon request, issue a certificate of adoption in the form that you suggest here, and then let it go at that, so that we don't require its issuance in every case, because in many cases it is absolutely nothing going to do with it.
I won't breathe and die for making it mandatory, Senator Cook. In fact, I won't. I think this is a very good, helpful bill that, as Senator Cook has pointed out, makes you feel better, but I think more than that, it has the virtue of preserving confidentiality of confidential information, and I think for some of the time, I'd rather not to go on unless there are questions.
Okay, John, would you like to turn to 887?
Yes, I thought you probably want to. I ask whether the committee had the revised form of the bill, which, as you can see, involves tipping and pasting, and not pasting, stapling, unfortunately. And this resulted from primarily from the Paul Meyer, the attorney for the American. And myself and Mr. Simmel trying to iron out this bill to the satisfaction of the pen of attorneys for the Civil Liberties Union from a constitutional standpoint. He advised me that he approves the bill as revised. That has been quite a struggle. And also to point up some of the sections in the original bill that were kind of out of place of this revised bill, I hope you will find more intelligible. Still, as always occurs when you're working hastily and dealing with important things, errors still appear notwithstanding. I apologize to you, but I'm there are three references that are erroneous. Page 7 of the revised bill, line 8, where it says section 5 should read section 4. And the same way on that same page, line 14, where the first section 5 should read section 4.
Could you please repeat those two? I was still trying to find
this
that.
This is on page 7 of the revised bill, and that's paging at the bottom.
Right.
Line 8 reference to section 5, it should read 4.
Right.
Line 14, same way, 5 should read 4.
Right.
And 17, line 5 should read 4.
Thank you.
Now, as Mr. Meyer, I think very eloquently stated, the two remarks he made on April 4th when the committee was unable to hear this bill, he said that civil liberties union concern was not just the father, but also the mother, and also the child. I'm not a member of the civil liberties union. I'm not a constitutional lawyer. Paul and I scratched over this bill in many regards. But I think that was a statement I will heartily subscribe to. Secondly, Mr. Meyer said that maybe he was responsible for the predicament we're in because of his carrying the adoption case to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that held our statute in this regard unconstitutional, the adoption statute, and denying the father of a child born out of wedlock equal protection of the law to mother. That's the decision of Miller versus Miller that I'm referring to in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And as Mr. Meyer pointed out, he feels, and I think that we all do, that we do have a gun to our head and that something must be done, just like in relation to follow the Supreme Court of the United States in the Stanley versus Illinois decision, that first, you might say, up that law of restitution to fathers has been followed by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that, for the sake of the rights of children, their welfare, that we cannot have their adoption, their achieving permanent home blocked by of what courts have held the unconstitutional statute. Now, I don't know how familiar you are, whether you want to ask me questions or whether you want me to give a synopsis. I want to spare your time and try to present this effectively.
Chairman? Yes, Senator Clark.
Now, how do you reconcile this and the other bill? Do you think that they can be reconciled or should be reconciled? Can we lift certain sections or should we lift certain sections of 887 and put it into the other adoption bill?
I'm biased. I favor 887. This late stage legislature, I fear.
Oh, we're going to be here another month and a half.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that's
adjourning tomorrow.
If I can reach my life on that Sunday. I fear it would be a hurt.
You agree?
Hurt me or shout. There are. Let me try to put it to a head. Senate Bill 132, as I see it, makes probably good and healthy revisions in filiation proceedings. I have no knowledge worth mentioning of filiation proceedings. I do not think I'm the one to pass on the merits or demerits of improvements made there.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
I wonder if this isn't, I don't usually think much of this procedure, but I wonder if this isn't the time to use the Norm Howard approach, which is to have these two gentlemen go out later and come back and sit down and figure
frankly, I grant the idea of a judge being able to put a mother on the stand and make her testify under penalty of contempt of court as to sexual relations with men, or even necessarily of men being, or a man being put on the rack and subject to the same thing. I need a lot more depth and thought before I can buy that kind of thing.
Well, I think we'll leave that decision to the chairman as to whether or not Senator Halleck approach of getting the several parties together to Howard. I won't even, I'm familiar with it in that context. But I would.
Well, you know what would be helpful, Senator Brown, is this. I don't know, maybe the other members really are following these intricacies, but it would really be nice if someone would go through and outline it, and here's where we're in agreement. Maybe you could do this. They're in agreement right down to here, and then point out to us the areas of disagreement so we can zap through that thing and decide it and get it done. If you really want one of these bills done, that's the way to do it. Get it outlined for us and bring it in here and hand spoon feed it to us and lay it out. So all we have to do is go through and make the policy decisions and not have to worry about the rest of that.
Well, I've done that with the Civil Liberties Union. Give me some credit. And that was a task. And I suppose it would be a tripartite matter that you're suggesting. Certainly I am not feel qualified to speak on constitutional issues.
Mr. Myers would be a necessary ingredient of that stew.
I sure would. The three of you would get together and come in with an outline in the next week so we can get it out and not get it lost. If it's gone complicated, lots of bills are lost because nobody bothers to get around to explaining them.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. I'll have the chairman, if you'll just stand by, as soon as this particular hearing is over, get in touch with you and Mr. Coffins.
Thank you.
I think we'll resolve how we can best resolve these two bills. I might also add for the record that Jay Folberg at the Northwestern School of Law does have before the Human Resources a artificial insemination bill to which there are also references in Senate Bill 132, and so it would appear that possibly the appropriate procedure would be to cannibalize 132 and put whatever portions in the area of artificial insemination is appropriate into the Jay Folberg bill, and those portions which are appropriate into the Senate Bill 887, and delineate those areas where agreement cannot be reached between Mr. Hawkins and Mr. Myers and children represented by Mr. Joss. Thank you very much. George, hear me?
Bernie.
He stuck his head in, but he's gone.
Stuart Stimmel.
What bill are we on?
Boys and Girls Aid Society is still on 887. Good morning, Mr. Stimmel.
Chairman, members of the committee, I am the administrator of Boys and Girls Aid Society of Oregon, and my primary concern is to see that as few children get caught up in the system and denied what I feel is a very basic right to a permanent home. And unfortunately, this does happen to thousands of children all of the time, tens of thousands in the United States. I'm also vitally concerned about the rights of the biological parents and the rights of the adopting parents when a child is
losing his original home and needs to have a new permanent home through adoption. I didn't sign up in regard to 132 or 846 because I thought it would save the committee's time if, when I appear on 887, I merely mentioned that I am very much in favor of the Bill 846 in regard to a certificate of adoption. Long before Multnomah County started issuing those, the Boys and Girls Aid Society, for its own adoptions, prepared and gave families a certificate of adoption, which of course had no standing other than a paper to the effect that the society did hold in its possession a decree, but it made the families definitely feel better, and most families, in our experience, do not want to have the full decree with the names of the biological parents, and they do want to have something, and 846 would be helpful to them. Senate Bill 887 is the one which I am speaking enthusiastically about. There is a very serious problem, which all of you know, that is resulting throughout the country at the present time in large numbers of mothers feeling that they no longer can consider releasing children for adoption, at least not through authorized channels, because in many states, procedures have developed involving publication, involving general publicity, or involving long delays where the mother knows that the child would go into foster care and maybe never get out, while there is an endless search. As one administrator of an Illinois agency was telling me the other day, we have now located the first 11 men on the list, but we don't know when it's going to be possible for us ever to have this child declared free for adoption. That isn't customary, but unfortunately, Senate Bill 132 exposes the mother to being forced under possible civil contempt to list any and all men who might, under any circumstances, possibly be the father, and then involve publication if they can't otherwise be reached. And I can speak from direct experience in saying that most of the girls and women with whom we work, and we have an extensive maternity care program at Boys and Girls Aid Society, most of them would never release a child under the circumstances that are outlined in Senate Bill 132. We do feel that 887 is extremely important to plug the hole which presently exists, and we can't afford to go another 2 years leaving the situation as it presently rests after Miller versus Miller, and there is no adequate legislation in the state. So that it is critical, in my opinion, if we're not going to just pile kids up in foster homes, to have legislation. I would certainly hope that the committee would adopt 887, which, as far as I know, has no serious opposition. And this would provide a period, Senator Cook, so that if there are generalized improvements in things which could be worked out to have a bill introduced in the next session of the legislature, but I would hope that we would not tie up this bill with attempts to reconcile some sections of 132. I have gone through 132 line by line. I think there are many complications in the actual procedure as far as the individuals are concerned in the early sections of it, and I think the latter sections are disastrous in regard to freeing children for adoption. So that I think that to the extent that 132 has any merit, it should have considerable study, and I think that it is far too late in this session of the legislature to do it. I would urgently hope that 887 would receive favorable consideration in this committee.
Mr. Stimmel, since you had the opportunity to do that section by section analysis of 132, I hope that if Chairman Elizabeth Brown does decide to ask for a tripartite group, that we would make it a four-corner group and ask you to be a key member of that group.
I would be very happy to do so.
Thank you very much.
Incidentally, I was asked just yesterday afternoon by the Metropolitan Youth Commission when they found that they were not going to be able to appear personally in favor of 887, and they asked me to bring down a letter. Those are copies for the various members of the committee supporting Senate Bill 887. And in talking with Mr. Meyer recently, just a couple of days ago from the American Civil Liberties Union, he asked me also to say that he certainly was in favor of Senate Bill 887.
Mr. Meyer.
All of those. Mr. Meyer of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Thank you very much. Any further questions for Mr. Stimmel? Barbara Davis, CSB, CSD.
I have some testimony through 887. I won't take up the committee's time. I'll just pass it out.
Right.
We agree with the concept of 887 and agree with the testimony of Mr. Dodds and Mr. Stimmel. You might point out that there are altogether four bills that deal with the rights of natural fathers. There's House Bill 2119 and 2122, which CSD submitted, which are presently waiting the outcome of 887. And of course, 132 is referred. We believe 887 is more comprehensive and leaves less room for misinterpretation than do the other three. This has been discussed with the Attorney General's Office, and the Attorney General's Office concurs.
I would hope just for future reference that in the drafting stages of these bills, there might be more coordination so that we won't end up with duplicating bills, all of which have some unique advantages, where there's a requirement that we somehow amalgamate the best out of each.
Hasn't happened in the last 10 years, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate that.
The last 14 years.
That's a good idea, though.
Yeah,
it's like trying to avoid sin before the next session. I appreciate
right.
that's a fine hope. Thank you very much. Chris at Nave. My reading is not.
I really didn't sign up for 132, but I was out of time. Most of what I have to say has been said, and apparently 132 is not in great favor at the moment, so perhaps I can skip a lot of it. You have to take a number of things wrong. I'd just like to make some general comments on the purpose of these bills. I don't think that the family case is going to stand when they get around to considering a case that involves an unwed mother giving up the child immediately after the child was born. The family case involved a common law marriage involving family, as I recall. And that was quite a different situation. In the Miller case in Oregon was somewhat like that. It also involved people who were living together. My concern is about the young woman who has a child who may or may not know who the father of the child is, but in any case doesn't want to make a great fuss about it. The father of the child is not taking her, he is not around. And I am very, very uncomfortable with the sort of publication that goes on in the state of Illinois, particularly where in the girl's home.
change in our law now that the other statute has been shut down. And he made a suggestion which I would certainly endorse, but for one thing, I would like to see however it comes out. I just thought he was joining, so I can't go through line by line. I think there are some good things in 132, but I would hate to see what it is. I would like to see the burden be on the father. If he has not stuck around during the pregnancy, doesn't know when the child is born, isn't that interested, I think he has almost forfeited his rights. I would perhaps be willing to give him a week or so to come around and make a claim for the child. I think our real interest should be for the child, especially in a case where the father hasn't been around, hasn't demonstrated any real concern. We need to get the child adopted as speedily as possible. There's plenty of evidence to show that early childhood care is especially important. It's likely to be better if the child can be adopted speedily. So I would favor 887, which I'm told here, and I'm willing to accept it, though I can't really build it out at the moment, but 887 does, in fact, put the burden on the father that he has to show up and claim his right. I would be inclined to say if he hasn't done it by the time the child was born or 5 days afterwards, he has a little chance to be in Mexico or something, but he should have made it known that he wishes to be considered as the adopted parent and have the opportunity to be considered first before other people. The court decides that he is suitable. Probably would be better for the child to be adopted by him. However, the suggestion that Nick made was, and I would certainly support this, that the termination of parental rights be a part of that filiation proceeding, that he is unable to, he's able to prove that he is a father, and he wants the child, but the court decides that he is not the appropriate person, that his parental rights be terminated at that point so the child can be released for adoption. Children get hung in limbo in foster homes for the young man, especially maybe the minor, who isn't possibly going to be able to adopt the child. And I think it would be appropriate to make a decision once and for all, just as the adoptive mother, once she makes a decision, it's over, the child can be adopted. I have a lot of questions that we're getting to, but
We have a bill from Tom Bessonette, a recent Court of Appeals case that held that where you'd been convicted of a criminal charge that happened to be a traffic, I think, at the time, that it was admissible in the civil negligence area, and that issue was raised through the county. You couldn't bring it up again. And this bill limits the admissibility of disposition of a criminal charge and subsequent civil action arising out of the same accident or occurrence. He wants to go into the judiciary.
What's the rule? We've got that chance of getting it passed. It's right now. Okay. Seems to me. So I'll make the motion at the end of this.
Quick call roll.
W. Brown.
Aye.
Cook. Robert.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Madam Chairman.
Aye. Vernon had a bill on 748.